Welcome back to The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. The history of America is the history of white trash. After the pilgrims came to these shores, these were the waste people that England sent to settle and work the colonies. From squatters to sharecroppers to purchasers of discounted Duck Dynasty merchandise at Walmart, who are the great unwashed white folk crackers who are invisible yet a fundamental part of the nation? Are they the backbone of the country or the spleen? Call us in. Who are the white trash? The number is 210-614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Nancy Eisenberg, and she's the author of the book White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And Nancy, hi, welcome to The Source.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So I feel like we're talking about my peeps today, the white trash. Am I in error? Am I just, you know, because I'm white in America, am I automatically white trash?
No, not really. Part of what I'm trying to do is uncover the roots of even this concept, white trash. Normally, people associate that term with the antebellum South. It first appears in newsprint in the 1820s. But it has a much longer history, which takes us all the way back to the period of British colonization, because the first promoters of settling the New World argued that the New World was a perfect place to dump what they called waste people. And this comes with the British obsession with equating people with the fertility of the land. And this is one of the things we forget. For most of our history, over half of our history, we were an agrarian nation. So the land was the source and substance of health, happiness, of economic success. So the people who were seen as white trash were the landless, people who didn't have land. And they also, from the British tradition, were associated with vagrants. And these were the mobile poor. And that's where the terms squatters and crackers come from, because those terms were the American version to talk about the migrating poor in the late 18th century into the 19th century who were moving into the backcountry and the western frontier.
So where does the word cracker come from? We've heard a lot of mythology about it. Some have said that it's from the cracking of the whip as the overseer of the slaves. We know the song of Jimmy Crack Corn and I Don't
Right.
Care. What is cracker?
Well, there is one connotation of cracking corn, which is a really cheap, inexpensive source of food. But the origins is much more complicated. It actually comes from the way in which the British were the first to describe lower class traders as being crackers, and they were described as being loud. They were described as being noisy braggarts. They were associated with vulgarity. So it comes from the English idea of like crack a jest or an Englishman who cracked wind. Firecrackers were associated with giving off a stench. There was a term louse cracker that's already in vogue, already in newsprint in the United States by the 1720s, which referred to a lice-ridden, slovenly fellow. But the term that I think is most important for cracker is the idea of crack-brained. This was the English slang for idle head, and that gets us back to this kind of English obsession with idleness. The way in which even Americans today dismiss the poor as being lazy, that goes back to the English obsession by arguing that the poor were idle, they were unproductive. I argue that it's comparable to the way we talk about the engine of a car being idle. It wastes energy, but it goes nowhere. And that's exactly the way the British talked about idle lands, which were unproductive, or vagrants who were idle. Even though they might migrate miles and miles, they were out of the economy, and therefore they were producing nothing but waste.
So idle-minded and feeble-minded, they're not the same?
No, I mean, and that's, you know, I talk about how the way in which poverty later gets connected to the eugenics movement, and the eugenics movement highlighted the importance of being feeble-minded. So, yeah, there is a connection. Idle-headed was also connected, or crack-brained was someone who was not quite right, but it was also connected to this idea that you're not thinking. It's an unthinking person. So this is sort of another way we you know, dismiss the poor, assuming that they may move a lot, but they're not thinking.
So in the founding of America, you know, and there's no other figure greater than Benjamin Franklin in that. And we all remember the story of him as a child going into Philadelphia with bread in his pockets as impoverished, and he was going to make his way in the world. And he was poor, and he was going and of no means, and he was not white trash.
No, and Franklin, I talk a lot about Franklin because he's important. Franklin was a runaway servant, so he does have a connection to the idea of vagrancy, because in the 18th century, there were a lot of runaway servants. There were runaway slaves, runaway servants. He was a runaway apprentice, and that was sort of another sign of these people who were detached from the economy. And Franklin is not one who's at all sympathetic to the poor. Which is surprising, but not that surprising. You know, just because you come up from a poorer family doesn't necessarily mean you're more sympathetic to the poor. But he's the one who really highlights the idea of the myth of the Western frontier, that what the North American continent offered the British, and this he's writing this when he is still a British colonist, he argued was the size of the continent. And he developed a theory that became very popular, that by letting people migrate into the frontier, into the West, that would flatten out the class system, what he called a happy mediocrity.
But not a lot of distinction between that attitude, sending the poor, unwanted waste people into the West, as what England wanted to do when they sent them to Botany Bay and to the American colonies.
Right. I mean, that's why he's kind of echoing the British way of thinking, which is my other point, is that even though we had a revolution and we broke free of the British, we maintained most of their ideas about poverty and class. But the problem with Franklin's theory, even though it's appealing, is that if we actually look at the pattern of Western migration, what do we see happening? We see the class system being replicated. That, you know, we mythologize the pioneers moving west. But the problem is that if we look at land ownership in places like the Old Northwest or in Kentucky and Tennessee, the backcountry, what we see is that very powerful land speculators, the large landholders, the wealthiest people owned the most land. They had access to the land office, so they were given the best kind of land. So the same pattern that plagued Jefferson's Virginia, where 40% at the time of the revolution afterward, 40% of white men were landless. That same pattern would be even worse in the 1790s in Kentucky, where the majority of people did not own land. And those are the people who were called squatters and crackers. I mean, the word squatter is actually really important. It's first used to talk about the landless in Maine. And that's the other important thing. Even though we think of white trash as a southern phenomena, it's really a rural phenomena. And as I said, it has its roots in this British tradition. But squatter were literally people who were described as squatting down on land they didn't own.
Right.
And that's the opposite of the way the English defined land ownership or to have sovereignty.
To have standing.
To have sovereignty was to have standing.
Right.
Exactly.
And
even the word right means to be erect.
Okay.
So what could be the best insult but to describe the landless as squatters?
As a squatter. And so we're going to continue our conversation, talk about what does this legacy mean for today's class anxiety as we talk about white trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America with Nancy Eisenberg, 210-614-8980. This is The Source. It wasn't just a story about a man named Jed. The Beverly Hillbillies was laced with the meanings, the secret messages about the white trash, part of American class anxiety, the story of white trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. That's the name of the book we're talking about this half hour. Nancy Eisenberg is the author, and you're invited into the conversation, 210-614-8980. What do you think when someone says, that's white trash, or other trailer trash, other things, cracker? Where did all this come from? What does it mean? And who are these people? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. So, Nancy, what is the Beverly Hillbillies? You write about it in your book. What do you tell us?
Yeah, one of the important things, and this is, again, a part of a history that we forget, in the early 60s when this came out, one of the anxieties and one of the things that was written about in the newspapers and debated was the mass migration of poor whites who headed north and created what were called hillbilly ghettos in cities such as Baltimore, St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago, Cincinnati. And in direct, in reaction to the Beverly Hillbillies, a syndicated columnist, Paul Harvey, made the point to his readers in 1968. He said, suppose a real-life likeness of TV's Beverly Hillbillies should move to the big city without those millions of dollars in the bank. So this is, you know, one of our part of our history that we don't pay attention to. We talk a lot about the mass migration of poor blacks into the North, but there was also a comparable mass migration. And what's amazing is that the same kind of nasty slurs that were used against blacks in cities were applied to poor Appalachian whites. So the Beverly Hillbillies was tapping into that anxiety. And I think even today, when we look at reality TV, we can look at it in terms of Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, that this is a kind of voyeurism, a way for people to distance themselves and say, well, you know, our life is better than that, to make sure that we understand who's really horrible, who's really, you know, the focus of satire, the focus of a kind of
sure,
really
but didn't,
nasty
but wasn't there
kind
also a romanticization of the white trash in these programs like Mayberry and Beverly Hillbillies or even Green Acres, you know, that there was
an
earthy
have
wisdom that comes from these folks that are uneducated, yet they're able to pull one over on the city slickers and
right.
the capitalist Mr. Drysdale.
Right. You have two traditions. I mean, you have the vaudeville tradition. I mean, remember Minnie Pearl, Hee-Haw. She came from an upper-class background. She was well-educated. So, yeah, there's this tradition, and even politicians appropriated this hillbilly ideal. And you're right. Another writer for the Los Angeles Times said that the Beverly Hillbillies was really tapping in to, you know, America's obsession with their own class consciousness. And you're right, it was, they described it as the snobs versus the slobs, and even had this hilarious line at the end where he said the TV series cashes in on Groucho Marx's theory of class struggle, or was that Karl Marx? So yeah, you have both of those traditions, and that's why there's a difference. I think even in reality TV, you have the kind of really nasty ones which are voyeuristic, where, you know, a show like Duck Dynasty is more in the tradition of, you know, talking about, you know, the redneck and how the redneck has certain skills. But you have that exact same thing because right. the Robinson clan were extremely wealthy. They belonged to the country club. And then they sort of appropriated this identity of being the Duck Dynasty for the television show.
Cool.
And I think that's really part of a modern phenomena, which I talk about, in the 1970s when Americans wanted to rediscover their roots, whether it was ethnic roots, then they also began to start talking about and celebrating their redneck roots.
Redneck, we'll talk about that too, but let's get to the phones. 210-614-8980. Diane is on the line. Diane, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Why, thanks.
Go ahead.
So I'm equating white trash today specifically with, and I think it's really denigrating as a term. However, to me, it means poorly or uneducated people, the people out there buying all the guns and swelling the ranks of Donald Trump supporters.
All right, Diane, thank you for the call. You know, a lot of people love guns. You know, you don't have to be white trash to do that or education level. But Donald Trump supporters, that's interesting because Nancy Eisenberg, author of White Trash, he seems to be tapping into that class anxiety.
Yeah, I've written about this and been interviewed about this. You know, early on, Trump, particularly when he was campaigning in the South, was attacked for cornering the white trash vote. People were doing studies claiming his core constituency possessed a high school degree or less and were likely to live in a trailer.
And he loves the uneducated.
New studies have shown, this is Nate Silver, who's argued that Trump's actual voters on average are wealthier than Clinton's or Sanders' constituency. But I think what led attention to dismissing Trump's followers as white trash were the visual images of the rallies, the emphasis on his racist rhetoric. And I think what's also important is that Trump himself, if we think of Trump as a performer, he does use a style, what his followers call raw honesty. But it is. He's vulgar. He's rude. He's thrown any kind of etiquette and decorum out the window. And that taps into people like James Vardaman, the Southern politicians who, as Vardaman said, democracy, American democracy should be as dirty as the people are. And that's where we can see the parallels and why people are saying that Trump has the white trash vote. But it's also extremely misleading because the real white trash historically are the poor. They've been the disenfranchised, just like poor blacks in the South under Jim Crow laws. Poor whites were disenfranchised.
Right, because a lot of people think that the poll tax was directly targeting the black voter, but it was really elimination of the poor voter, including the white trash.
Right, and that's what we forget. We forget that Southern elites didn't like poor whites at all. And when Vardaman tried to, tap into that support, his major attackers, his major critics, were the Southern elites. So this is another thing we have to realize about our political past, is that politicians have often used this strategy of pitting poor whites against blacks and used racism as a way to tap into people's fears, but also it taps into this logic of a zero-sum game,
sure,
which has been used over and over again, that if you give one person some kind of benefit, it detracts from another group's.
Right.
Opportunities or chances.
And LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, knew that. He had said famously that if you can convince the poorest white guy that he's better
right.
than the richest black guy, that you can get him, you can pick his pocket. So
right.
let's get back.
Yeah, can I just add one thing about Lyndon Johnson's quote? What is so amazing about that quote is John Adams, and I'm talking about John Adams, who was the second president of the United States, in 1790 said exactly the same thing. He argued that Americans were not only scrambling to get ahead, they needed someone to disparage. And he wrote, "There must be one, indeed, who is the last and the lowest of the human species." This need, and I think this is part of the class system, people are willing to tolerate a wealthy elite just as long as they have someone else to look down on.
Okay, Manuel has called in. Manuel, welcome to this. Well, we lost him. Let's go to Jack. Hey, Jack, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, I'd read a book one time. It was called Great Britain and the American Civil War, and it talked about the British. They were just appalled at how in America you had the lowest class people would be eating in these fancy houses with the upper class. The British couldn't stand the way you had the classes working together in the United States.
The intermingling of the classes?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you can compare and contrast Europe to what it was like in the United States, the lower classes here were ate much better than the a lot of the upper class in Europe. You had a lot more protein in the diet, and
sure,
people worked together. I guess it's because they had guns. You had to respect them, be more gentle,
and we had more wildlife to go get. All right, thank you, Jack. Any response to that, Nancy Eisenberg?
Well, I think it really refers to when you're talking about there was a great deal of hunger and starvation that gets associated with poor white trash. There were diseases like hookworm and pellagra that plagued white trash into the 20th century. So the idea that all Americans ate better or all of Americans somehow did better than the poor in Great Britain is not really true. We just have to be careful how we generalize and which group of people we're talking about.
It's the language in your book is incredible. There's so many great insults that you learn from reading this book, and the off-scourging, lubbers, bog trotters, rascals, rubbish, squatters, crackers, clay eaters. Why clay eaters? Did they really eat clay?
Yes, they actually did eat clay. And believe it or not, there are people who eat clay today. Part of it is a mineral deficiency. I write about hookworm, which is a horrible, horrible disease that was the result of people going barefoot. And worms would actually enter their system and make them extremely thin and unhealthy. Pellagra is the one that also contributed to the yellowing of the skin. And that's the other thing that is remarkable. White trash, and this begins even with descriptions of squatters in Indiana, begin to be described as having a yellowish tint to their skin.
But today, have they moved up? Are they in the middle class? Or are they still the working poor? What's happened to the white trash of America? They certainly have the right to vote and a part of America. They're a part of the backbone of America. I want to thank Nancy Eisenberg, the author of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.